The Misadventures of John Nicholson, Chapter I, in which John sows the wind. John Barry Nicholson was stupid, yet, stupider men than he are now sprawling in Parliament, and lauding themselves as the authors of their own distinction. He was of a fat habit, even from boyhood, and inclined to a cheerful and cursory reading of the face of life, and possibly this attitude of mind was the original cause of his misfortunes. Beyond this hint, philosophy is silent on his career, and superstition steps in with the more ready explanation that he was detested of the gods. His father, that iron gentleman, had long ago enthroned himself on the heights of the disruption principles. What these are, and in spite of their grim name they are quite innocent, no array of terms would render thinkable to the merely English intelligence, but to the Scot they often prove unctuously nourishing, and Mr. Nicholson found in them the milk of lions. About the period when the churches convened at Edinburgh in their annual assemblies, he was to be seen descending the mound in the company of divers red-headed clergymen, these voluble, he only contributing oracular nods, brief negatives, and the austere spectacle of his stretched upper lip. The names of Candlish and Begg were frequent in these interviews, and occasionally the talk ran on the residuary establishment and the doings of Wanley. A stranger to the tight little theological kingdom of Scotland might have listened and gathered literally nothing. And Mr. Nicholson, who was not a dull man, knew this, and raged at it. He knew there was a vast world outside, to whom disruption principles were as the chatter of treetop apes. The paper brought him chill whiffs from it. He had met Englishmen who had asked lightly if he did not belong to the Church of Scotland, and then had failed to be much interested by his elucidation of that nice point. It was an evil, wild, rebellious world, lying sunk in underscore dozenness underscore, for nothing short of a Scots word will paint this Scotsman's feelings. And when he entered into his own house in Randolph Crescent, South Side, and shut the door behind him, his heart swelled with security. Here, at least, was a citadel impregnable by right-hand defections or left-hand extremes. Here was a family where prayers came at the same hour, where the Sabbath literature was unimpeachably selected, where the guest who should have leaned to any false opinion was instantly set down, and over which there reigned all week, and grew denser on Sundays, a silence that was agreeable to his ear, and a gloom that he found comfortable. Mrs. Nicholson had died about 30, and left him with three children, a daughter 2 years, and a son about 8 years younger than John, and John himself, the unlucky bearer of a name infamous in English history. The daughter, Maria, was a good girl, dutiful, pious, dull, but so easily startled that to speak to her was quite a perilous enterprise. "I don't think I care to talk about that, if you please," she would say, and strike the boldest speechless by her unmistakable pain, this upon all topics, dress, pleasure, morality, politics, in which the formula was changed to "my papa thinks otherwise," and even religion, unless it was approached with a particular whining tone of voice. Alexander, the younger brother, was sickly, clever, fond of books and drawing, and full of satirical remarks. In the midst of these, imagine that natural, clumsy, unintelligent, and mirthful animal, John, mighty well behaved in comparison with other lads, although not up to the mark of the house in Randolph Crescent, full of a sort of blundering affection, full of caresses, which were never very warmly received, full of sudden and loud laughter which rang out in that still house like curses. Mr. Nicholson himself had a great fund of humor, of the Scots order, intellectual, turning on the observation of men, his own character, for instance, if he could have seen it in another, would have been a rare feast to him, but his son's empty guffaws over a broken plate, and empty, almost light-hearted remarks, struck him with pain as the indices of a weak mind. Outside the family, John had early attached himself, much as a dog may follow a marquis, to the steps of Alan Houston, a lad about a year older than himself, idle, a trifle wild, the heir to a good estate which was still in the hands of a rigorous trustee, and so royally content with himself that he took John's devotion as a thing of course. The intimacy was called to Mr. Nicholson, it took his son from the house, and he was a jealous parent, it kept him from the office, and he was a martinet. Lastly, Mr. Nicholson was ambitious for his family, in which, and the disruption principles, he entirely lived, and he hated to see a son of his play second fiddle to an idler. After some hesitation, he ordered that the friendship should cease, an unfair command, though seemingly inspired by the spirit of prophecy, and John, saying nothing, continued to disobey the order under the rose. John was nearly 19 when he was one day dismissed rather earlier than usual from his father's office, where he was studying the practice of the law. It was Saturday, and except that he had a matter of £400 in his pocket which it was his duty to hand over to the British Linen Company's bank, he had the whole afternoon at his disposal. He went by Prince's Street enjoying the mild sunshine, and the little thrill of easterly wind that tossed the flags along that terrace of palaces, and tumbled the green trees in the garden. The band was playing down in the valley under the castle, and when it came to the turn of the pipers, he heard their wild sounds with a stirring of the blood. Something distantly martial woke in him, and he thought of Miss Mackenzie, whom he was to meet that day at dinner. Now, it is undeniable that he should have gone directly to the bank, but right in the way stood the billiard room of the hotel where Alan was almost certain to be found, and the temptation proved too strong. He entered the billiard room, and was instantly greeted by his friend, cue in hand. "Nicholson," said he, "I want you to lend me a pound or two till Monday." "You've come to the right shop, haven't you?" returned John. "I have tuppence." "Nonsense," said Alan. "You can get some. Go and borrow at your tailor's, they all do it. Or I'll tell you what, pop your watch."
"Oh, yes, I dare say," said John. "And how about my father?"
"How is he to know? He doesn't wind it up for you at night, does he?" inquired Alan, at which John guffawed. "No, seriously, I am in a fix," continued the tempter. "I have lost some money to a man here. I'll give it you tonight, and you can get the heirloom out again on Monday. Come, it's a small service, after all. I would do a good deal more for you." Whereupon John went forth, and pawned his gold watch under the assumed name of John Frogs, 85 Pleasance. But the nervousness that assailed him at the door of that inglorious haunt, a pawnshop, and the effort necessary to invent the pseudonym, which, somehow, seemed to him a necessary part of the procedure, had taken more time than he imagined, and when he returned to the billiard room with the spoils, the bank had already closed its doors. This was a shrewd knock. A piece of business had been neglected. He heard these words in his father's trenchant voice, and trembled, and then dodged the thought. After all, who was to know? He must carry £400 about with him till Monday, when the neglect could be surreptitiously repaired, and meanwhile, he was free to pass the afternoon on the encircling divan of the billiard room, smoking his pipe, sipping a pint of ale, and enjoying to the masthead the modest pleasures of admiration. None can admire like a young man. Of all youth's passions and pleasures, this is the most common and least alloyed, and every flash of Alan's black eyes, every aspect of his curly head, every graceful reach, every easy, standoff attitude of waiting, and down to his shirt sleeves and wrist links, were seen by John through a luxurious glory. He valued himself by the possession of that royal friend, hugged himself upon the thought, and swam in warm measure, his own defects, like vanquished difficulties, becoming things on which to plume himself. Only when he thought of Miss Mackenzie there fell upon his mind a shadow of regret, that young lady was worthy of better things than plain John Nicholson, still known among schoolmates by the derisive name of Fatty, and he felt, if he could chalk a cue, or stand at ease, with such a careless grace as Alan, he could approach the object of his sentiments with a less crushing sense of inferiority. Before they parted, Alan made a proposal that was startling in the extreme. He would be at Colette's that night about 12, he said. Why should not John come there and get the money? To go to Colette's was to see life, indeed, it was wrong, it was against the laws, it partook, in a very dingy manner, of adventure. Were it known, it was the sort of exploit that disconsidered a young man for good with the more serious classes, but gave him a standing with the riotous. And yet Colette's was not a hell, it could not come, without vaulting hyperbole, under the rubric of a gilded saloon, and, if it was a sin to go there, the sin was merely local and municipal. Colette, whose name I do not know how to spell, for I was never in epistolary communication with that hospitable outlaw, was simply an unlicensed publican, who gave suppers after 11 at night, the Edinburgh hour of closing. If you belonged to a club, you could get a much better supper at the same hour, and lose not a jot in public esteem. But if you lacked that qualification, and were unhungered, or inclined toward conviviality at unlawful hours, Colette's was your only port. You were very ill supplied. The company was not recruited from the Senate or the Church, though the bar was very well represented on the only occasion on which I flew in the face of my country's laws, and, taking my reputation in my hand, penetrated into that grim supper house. And Colette's frequenters, thrillingly conscious of wrongdoing and that two-handed engine, the policeman, at the door, were perhaps inclined to somewhat feverish excess. But the place was in no sense a very bad one, and it is somewhat strange to me, at this distance of time, how it had acquired its dangerous repute.
In precisely the same spirit as a man may debate a project to ascend the Matterhorn or to cross Africa, John considered Alan's proposal, and, greatly daring, accepted it. As he walked home, the thoughts of this excursion out of the safe places of life into the wild and arduous, stirred and struggled in his imagination with the image of Miss Mackenzie, incongruous and yet kindred thoughts, for did not each imply unusual tightening of the pegs of resolution? Did not each woo him forth and warn him back again into himself? Between these two considerations, at least, he was more than usually moved, and when he got to Randolph Crescent, he quite forgot the £400 in the inner pocket of his greatcoat, hung up the coat, with its rich freight, upon his particular pin of the hat stand, and in the very action sealed his doom. Chapter 2 In which John reaps the whirlwind. About 10:30 it was John's brave good fortune to offer his arm to Miss Mackenzie, and escort her home. The night was chill and starry. All the way eastward the trees of the different gardens rustled and looked black. Up the stone gully of Leith Walk, when they came to cross it, the breeze made a rush and set the flames of the street lamps quavering, and when at last they had mounted to the Royal Terrace, where Captain Mackenzie lived, a great salt freshness came in their faces from the sea. These faces of the walk remained written on John's memory, each emphasized by the touch of that light hand on his arm, and behind all these aspects of the nocturnal city he saw, in his mind's eye, a picture of the lighted drawing room at home where he had sat talking with Flora, and his father, from the other end, had looked on with a kind and ironical smile. John had read the significance of that smile, which might have escaped a stranger. Mr. Nicholson had remarked his son's entanglement with satisfaction, tinged by humor, and his smile, if it still was a thought contemptuous, had implied consent. At the captain's door the girl held out her hand, with a certain emphasis, and John took it and kept it a little longer, and said, "Good night, Flora, dear," and was instantly thrown into much fear by his presumption. But she only laughed, ran up the steps, and rang the bell, and while she was waiting for the door to open, kept close in the porch, and talked to him from that point as out of a fortification. She had a knitted shawl over her head, her blue Highland eyes took the light from the neighboring street lamp and sparkled, and when the door opened and closed upon her, John felt cruelly alone. He proceeded slowly back along the terrace in a tender glow, and when he came to Greenside Church, he halted in a doubtful mind. Over the crown of the Calton Hill, to his left, lay the way to Colette's, where Alan would soon be looking for his arrival, and where he would now have no more consented to go than he would have willfully wallowed in a bog. The touch of the girl's hand on his sleeve, and the kindly light in his father's eyes, both loudly forbidding. But right before him was the way home, which pointed only to bed, a place of little ease for one whose fancy was strung to the lyrical pitch, and whose not very ardent heart was just then tumultuously moved. The hilltop, the cool air of the night, the company of the great monuments, the sight of the city under his feet, with its hills and valleys and crossing files of lamps, drew him by all he had of the poetic, and he turned that way, and by that quite innocent deflection, ripened the crop of his venial errors for the sickle of destiny. On a seat on the hill above Greenside he sat for perhaps 30 minutes, looking down upon the lamps of Edinburgh, and up at the lamps of heaven. Wonderful were the resolves he formed, beautiful and kindly were the vistas of future life that sped before him. He uttered to himself the name of Flora in so many touching and dramatic keys, that he became at length fairly melted with tenderness, and could have sung aloud. At that juncture a certain creasing in his greatcoat caught his ear. He put his hand into his pocket, pulled forth the envelope that held the money, and sat stupefied. The Calton Hill, about this period, had an ill name of knights, and to be sitting there with £400 that did not belong to him was hardly wise. He looked up. There was a man in a very bad hat a little on one side of him, apparently looking at the scenery, from a little on the other a second night walker was drawing very quietly near. Up jumped John. The envelope fell from his hands, he stooped to get it, and at the same moment both men ran in and closed with him. A little after, he got to his feet very sore and shaken, the poorer by a purse which contained exactly 1 penny postage stamp, by a cambric handkerchief, and by the all-important envelope. Here was a young man on whom, at the highest point of lovely exaltation, there had fallen a blow too sharp to be supported alone, and not many hundred yards away his greatest friend was sitting at supper, and even expecting him. Was it not in the nature of man that he should run there? He went in quest of sympathy, in quest of that droll article that we all suppose ourselves to want when in a strait, and have agreed to call advice, and he went, besides, with vague but rather splendid expectations of relief. Alan was rich, or would be so when he came of age. By a stroke of the pen he might remedy this misfortune, and avert that dreaded interview with Mr. Nicholson, from which John now shrunk in imagination as the hand draws back from fire. Close under the Calton Hill there runs a certain narrow avenue, part street, part byroad. The head of it faces the doors of the prison, its tail descends into the sunless slums of the Low Calton. On one hand it is overhung by the crags of the hill, on the other by an old graveyard. Between these two the roadway runs in a trench, sparsely lighted at night, sparsely frequented by day, and bordered, when it was cleared the place of tombs, by dingy and ambiguous houses. One of these was the house of Colette, and at his door a real star John was presently beating for admittance. In an evil hour he satisfied the jealous inquiries of the contraband hotel keeper, in an evil hour he penetrated into the somewhat unsavory interior. Alan, to be sure, was there, seated in a room lighted by noisy gas jets, beside a dirty tablecloth, engaged on a coarse meal, and in the company of several tipsy members of the junior bar. But Alan was not sober, he had lost £1,000 upon a horse race, had received the news at dinner time, and was now, in default of any possible means of extrication, drowning the memory of his predicament. He to help John. The thing was impossible, he couldn't help himself. "If you have a beast of a father," said he, "I can tell you I have a brute of a trustee." "I'm not going to hear my father called a beast," said John with a beating heart, feeling that he risked the last sound rivet of the chain that bound him to life. But Alan was quite good-natured. "All right, old fellow," said he. "Most respectable man your father." And he introduced his friend to his companions as old Nicholson the what do you call 'em's son. John sat in dumb agony. Colette's foul walls and maculate table linen, and even down to Colette's villainous casters, seemed like objects in a nightmare. And just then there came a knock and a scurrying. The police, so lamentably absent from the Calton Hill, appeared upon the scene, and the party, taken _ flagrante delicto _, with their glasses at their elbow, were seized, marched up to the police office, and all duly summoned to appear as witnesses in the consequent case against that arch-abener, Colette. It was a sorrowful and a mightily sobered company that came forth again. The vague terror of public opinion weighed generally on them all, but there were private and particular horrors on the minds of individuals. Alan stood in dread of his trustee, already sorely tried. One of the group was the son of a country minister, another of a judge. John, the unhappiest of all, had David Nicholson to father, the idea of facing whom on such a scandalous subject was physically sickening. They stood a while consulting under the buttresses of St. Giles, thence they adjourned to the lodgings of one of the number in North Castle Street, where, for that matter, they might have had quite as good a supper, and far better drink, than in the dangerous paradise from which they had been routed. There, over an almost tearful glass, they debated their position. Each explained he had the world to lose if the affair went on, and he appeared as a witness. It was remarkable what bright prospects were just then in the very act of opening before each of that little company of youths, and what pious consideration for the feelings of their families began now to well from them. Each, moreover, was in an odd state of destitution. Not one could bear his share of the fine, not one but evinced a wonderful twinkle of hope that each of the others, in succession, was the very man who could step in to make good the deficit. One took a high hand, he could not pay his share, if it went to a trial, he should bolt, he had always felt the English bar to be his true sphere. Another branched out into touching details about his family, and was not listened to. John, in the midst of this disorderly competition of poverty and meanness, sat stunned, contemplating the mountain bulk of his misfortunes. At last, upon a pledge that each should apply to his family with a common frankness, this convention of unhappy young asses broke up, went down the common stair, and in the grey of the spring morning, with the streets lying dead empty all about them, the lamps burning on into the daylight in diminished lustre, and the birds beginning to sound premonitory notes from the groves of the town gardens, went each his own way with bowed head and echoing footfall. The rooks were awake in Randolph Crescent, but the windows looked down, discreetly blinded, on the return of the prodigal. John's passkey was a recent privilege, this was the first time it had been used, and, oh! With what a sickening sense of his unworthiness he now inserted it into the well-oiled lock and entered that citadel of the proprieties. All slept, the gas in the hall had been left faintly burning to light his return, a dreadful stillness reigned, broken by the deep ticking of the 8-day clock. He put the gas out, and sat on a chair in the hall, waiting and counting the minutes, longing for any human countenance. But when at last he heard the alarm spring its rattle in the lower story, and the servants began to be about, he instantly lost heart, and fled to his own room, where he threw himself upon the bed. Chapter 3, in which John enjoys the harvest home. Shortly after breakfast, at which he assisted with a highly tragical countenance, John sought his father where he sat, presumably in religious meditation, on the Sabbath mornings. The old gentleman looked up with that sour, inquisitive expression that came so near to smiling and was so different in effect. "This is a time when I do not like to be disturbed," he said. "I know that," returned John, "but I've made a dreadful mess of it," he broke out, and turned to the window. Mr. Nicholson sat silent for an appreciable time, while his unhappy son surveyed the poles in the back green, and a certain yellow cat that was perched upon the wall. Despair sat upon John as he gazed, and he raged to think of the dreadful series of his misdeeds, and the essential innocence that lay behind them. "Well," said the father, with an obvious effort, but in very quiet tones, "what is it?"
"McLean gave me £400 to put in the bank, sir," began John, "and I'm sorry to say that I've been robbed of it."
"Robbed of it?" cried Mr. Nicholson, with a strong rising inflection. "Robbed? Be careful what you say, John."
"I can't say anything else, sir, I was just robbed of it," said John, in desperation, sullenly.
"And where and when did this extraordinary event take place?" inquired the father.
"On the Calton Hill about 12 last night."
"The Calton Hill?" repeated Mr. Nicholson. "And what were you doing there at such a time of the night?"
"Nothing, sir," says John.
Mr. Nicholson drew in his breath.
"And how came the money in your hands at 12 last night?" he asked, sharply.
"I neglected that piece of business," said John, anticipating comment, and then in his own dialect, "I clean forgot all about it."
"Well," said his father, "it's a most extraordinary story. Have you communicated with the police?"
"I have," answered poor John, the blood leaping to his face. "They think they know the men that did it. I dare say the money will be recovered, if that was all," said he, with a desperate indifference, which his father set down to levity, but which sprung from the consciousness of worse behind.
"Your mother's watch, too?" asked Mr. Nicholson.
"Oh, the watch is all right," cried John. "At least, I mean I was coming to the watch. The fact is, I am ashamed to say, I had pawned the watch before. Here is the ticket, they didn't find that, the watch can be redeemed, they don't sell pledges." The lad panted out these phrases, one after another, like minute guns, but at the last word, which rang in that stately chamber like an oath, his heart failed him utterly, and the dreaded silence settled on father and son. It was broken by Mr. Nicholson picking up the pawn ticket, "John Frogs, 85 Pleasance," he read, and then turning upon John, with a brief flash of passion and disgust, "Who is John Frogs?" he cried.
"Nobody," said John. "It was just a name."
"An_alias_," his father commented.
"Oh. I think scarcely quite that," said the culprit. "It's a form, they all do it, the man seemed to understand, we had a great deal of fun over the name."
He paused at that, for he saw his father wince at the picture like a man physically struck, and again there was silence.
"I do not think," said Mr. Nicholson, at last, "that I am an ungenerous father. I have never grudged you money within reason, for any avowable purpose, you had just to come to me and speak. And now I find that you have forgotten all decency and all natural feeling, and actually pawned, your mother's watch. You must have had some temptation, I will do you the justice to suppose it was a strong one. What did you want with this money?"
"I would rather not tell you, sir," said John. "It will only make you angry."
"I will not be fenced with," cried his father. "There must be an end of disingenuous answers. What did you want with this money?"
"To lend it to Houston, sir," says John.
"I thought I had forbidden you to speak to that young man?" asked the father.
"Yes, sir," said John, "but I only met him."
"Where?" came the deadly question.
"And in a billiard room," was the damning answer. Thus, had John's single departure from the truth brought instant punishment. For no other purpose but to see Alan would he have entered a billiard room, but he had desired to palliate the fact of his disobedience, and now it appeared that he frequented these disreputable haunts upon his own account. Once more Mr. Nicholson digested the vile tidings in silence, and when John stole a glance at his father's countenance, he was abashed to see the marks of suffering.
"Well," said the old gentleman, "at last, I cannot pretend not to be simply bowed down. I rose this morning with the world calls a happy man, happy, at least, in a son of whom I thought I could be reasonably proud.
But it was beyond human nature to endure this longer, and John interrupted almost with a scream.
Oh, whist! He cried, that's not all, that's not the worst of it, it's nothing. How could I tell you were proud of me? Oh! I wish that I had known, but you always said I was such a disgrace. And the dreadful thing is this, we were all taken up last night, and we have to pay Colette's fine among the six, or we'll be head up for evidence, shebeening it is. They made me swear to tell you, but for my part, he cried, bursting into tears, I just wish that I was dead. And he fell on his knees before a chair and hid his face. Whether his father spoke, or whether he remained long in the room or at once departed, are points lost to history. A horrid turmoil of mind and body, bursting sobs, broken, vanishing thoughts, now of indignation, now of remorse, broken elementary whiffs of consciousness, of the smell of the horsehair on the chair bottom, of the jangling of church bells that now began to make day horrible throughout the confines of the city, of the hard floor that bruised his knees, of the taste of tears that found their way into his mouth, for a period of time, the duration of which I cannot guess, while I refuse to dwell longer on its agony, these were the whole of God's world for John Nicholson. When at last, as by the touching of a spring, he returned again to clearness of consciousness and even a measure of composure, the bells had but just done ringing, and the Sabbath silence was still marred by the patter of belated feet. By the clock above the fire, as well as by these more speaking signs, the service had not long begun, and the unhappy sinner, if his father had really gone to church, might count on near 2 hours of only comparative unhappiness. With his father, the superlative degree returned infallibly. He knew it by every shrinking fiber in his body, he knew it by the sudden dizzy whirling of his brain, at the mere thought of that calamity. An hour and a half, perhaps an hour and three quarters, if the doctor was long-winded, and then would begin again that active agony from which, even in the dull ache of the present, he shrunk as from the bite of fire. He saw, in a vision, the family pew, the somnolent cushions, the Bibles, the psalm books, Maria with her smelling salts, his father sitting spectacled and critical, and at once he was struck with indignation, not unjustly. It was inhuman to go off to church, and leave a sinner in suspense, unpunished, unforgiven. And at the very touch of criticism, the paternal sanctity was lessened, yet the paternal terror only grew, and the two strands of feeling pushed him in the same direction. And suddenly there came upon him a mad fear lest his father should have locked him in. The notion had no ground in sense, it was probably no more than a reminiscence of similar calamities in childhood, for his father's room had always been the chamber of inquisition and the scene of punishment, but it stuck so rigorously in his mind that he must instantly approach the door and prove its untruth. As he went, he struck upon a drawer left open in the business table. It was the money drawer, a measure of his father's disarray, the money drawer, perhaps appointing providence. Who is to decide, when even divines differ between a providence and a temptation? Or who, sitting calmly under his own vine, is to pass a judgment on the doings of a poor, hunted dog, slavishly afraid, slavishly rebellious, like John Nicholson on that particular Sunday? His hand was in the drawer, almost before his mind had conceived the hope, and rising to his new situation, he wrote, sitting in his father's chair and using his father's blotting pad, his pitiful apology and farewell. My dear father, I have taken the money, but I will pay it back as soon as I am able. You will never hear of me again. I did not mean any harm by anything, so I hope you will try and forgive me. I wish you would say goodbye to Alexander and Maria, but not if you don't want to. I could not wait to see you, really. Please try to forgive me. Your affectionate son. John Nicholson. The coins abstracted and the missive written. He could not be gone too soon from the scene of these transgressions, and remembering how his father had once returned from church, on some slight illness, in the middle of the second psalm, he durst not even make a packet of a change of clothes. Attired as he was, he slipped from the paternal doors, and found himself in the cool spring air, the thin spring sunshine, and the great Sabbath quiet of the city, which was now only pointed by the cawing of the rooks. There was not a soul in Randolph Crescent, nor a soul in Queen's Ferry Street. In this outdoor privacy and the sense of escape, John took heart again, and with a pathetic sense of leave-taking, he even ventured up the lane and stood a while, a strange period at the gates of a quaint paradise, by the west end of St. George's Church. They were singing within, and by a strange chance, the tune was St. George's, Edinburgh, which bears the name, and was first sung in the choir of that church. Who is this King of Glory? Went the voices from within, and, to John, this was like the end of all Christian observances, for he was now to be a wild man like Ishmael,
and his life was to be cast in homeless places and with godless people. It was thus, with no rising sense of the adventurous, but in mere desolation and despair, that he turned his back on his native city, and set out on foot for California, with a more immediate eye to Glasgow. Chapter 4 The Second Sowing. It is no part of mine to narrate the adventures of John Nicholson, which were many, but simply his more momentous misadventures, which were more than he desired, and, by human standards, more than he deserved, how he reached California, how he was rooked, and robbed, and beaten, and starved, how he was at last taken up by charitable folk, restored to some degree of self-complacency, and installed as a clerk in a bank in San Francisco. It would take too long to tell, nor in these episodes were there any marks of a peculiar Nicholsonic destiny, for they were just such matters as befell some thousands of other young adventurers in the same days and places. But once posted in the bank, he fell for a time into a high degree of good fortune, which, as it was only a longer way about to fresh disaster, it behooves me to explain. It was his luck to meet a young man in what is technically called a dive, and thanks to his monthly wages, to extricate this new acquaintance from a position of present disgrace and possible danger in the future. This young man was the nephew of one of the Nob Hill magnates, who run the San Francisco Stock Exchange, much as more humble adventurers, in the corner of some public park at home, may be seen to perform the simple artifice of pea and thimble, for their own profit, that is to say, and the discouragement of public gambling. It was thus in his power, and, as he was of grateful temper, it was among the things that he desired, to put John in the way of growing rich, and thus, without thought or industry, or so much as even understanding the game at which he played, but by simply buying and selling what he was told to buy and sell, that plaything of fortune was presently at the head of between 11,000 and 12,000 pounds, or, as he reckoned it, of upward of $60,000. How he had come to deserve this wealth, any more than how he had formerly earned disgrace at home, was a problem beyond the reach of his philosophy. It was true that he had been industrious at the bank, but no more so than the cashier, who had 7 small children and was visibly sinking in decline. Nor was the step which had determined his advance, a visit to a dive with a month's wages in his pocket, an act of such transcendent virtue, or even wisdom, as to seem to merit the favor of the gods. From some sense of this, and of the dizzy seesaw, heaven high, hell deep, on which men sit clutching, or perhaps fearing that the sources of his fortune might be insidiously traced to some root in the field of petty cash, he stuck to his work, said not a word of his new circumstances, and kept his account with a bank in a different quarter of the town. The concealment, innocent as it seems, was the first step in the second tragicomedy of John's existence. Meanwhile, he had never written home. Whether from diffidence or shame, or a touch of anger, or mere procrastination, or because, as we have seen, he had no skill in literary arts, or because, as I am sometimes tempted to suppose, there is a law in human nature that prevents young men, not otherwise beasts, from the performance of this simple act of piety, months and years had gone by, and John had never written. The habit of not writing, indeed, was already fixed before he had begun to come into his fortune, and it was only the difficulty of breaking this long silence that withheld him from an instant restitution of the money he had stolen or, as he preferred to call it, borrowed. In vain he sat before paper, attending on inspiration, that heavenly nymph, beyond suggesting the words "my dear father," remained obstinately silent, and presently John would crumple up the sheet and decide, as soon as he had a good chance, to carry the money home in person. And this delay, which is indefensible, was his second step into the snares of fortune. 10 years had passed, and John was drawing near to 30. He had kept the promise of his boyhood, and was now of a lusty frame, verging toward corpulence, good features, good eyes, a genial manner, a ready laugh, a long pair of sandy whiskers, a dash of an American accent, a close familiarity with the great American joke, and a certain likeness to a RYLPRSNGE, who shall remain nameless for me, made up the man's externals as he could be viewed in society. Inwardly, in spite of his gross body and highly masculine whiskers, he was more like a maiden lady than a man of 29. It chanced one day, as he was strolling down Market Street on the eve of his fortnight's holiday, that his eye was caught by certain railway bills, and in very idleness of mind he calculated that he might be home for Christmas if he started on the morrow. The fancy thrilled him with desire, and in one moment he decided he would go. There was much to be done, his portmanteau to be packed, a credit to be got from the bank where he was a wealthy customer, and certain offices to be transacted for that other bank in which he was an humble clerk, and it chanced, in conformity with human nature, that out of all this business it was the last that came to be neglected. Night found him, not only equipped with money of his own, but once more, as on that former occasion, saddled with a considerable sum of other people's. Now it chanced there lived in the same boarding house a fellow clerk of his, an honest fellow, with what is called a weakness for drink, though it might, in this case, have been called a strength, for the victim had been drunk for weeks together without the briefest intermission. To this unfortunate John entrusted a letter with an enclosure of bonds, addressed to the bank manager. Even as he did so he thought he perceived a certain haziness of eye and speech in his trustee, but he was too hopeful to be stayed, silenced the voice of warning in his bosom, and with one and the same gesture committed the money to the clerk, and himself into the hands of destiny. I dwell, even at the risk of tedium, on John's minutest errors, his case being so perplexing to the moralist, but we have done with them now, the roll is closed, the reader has the worst of our poor hero, and I leave him to judge for himself whether he or John has been the less deserving. Henceforth we have to follow the spectacle of a man who is a mere whip-top for calamity, on whose unmerited misadventures not even the humorist can look without pity, and not even the philosopher without alarm. That same night the clerk entered upon a bout of drunkenness so consistent as to surprise even his intimate acquaintance. He was speedily ejected from the boarding house, deposited his portmanteau with a perfect stranger, who did not even catch his name, wandered he knew not where, and was at last hove to, all standing, in a hospital at Sacramento. There, under the impenetrable underscore alias underscore of the number of his bed, the crapulous being lay for some more days unconscious of all things, and of one thing in particular, that the police were after him. 2 months had come and gone before the convalescent in the Sacramento hospital was identified with Kirkman, the absconding San Francisco clerk. Even then, there must elapse nearly a fortnight more till the perfect stranger could be hunted up, the portmanteau recovered, and John's letter carried at length to its destination, the seal still unbroken, the enclosure still intact. Meanwhile, John had gone upon his holidays without a word, which was irregular, and there had disappeared with him a certain sum of money, which was out of all bounds of palliation. But he was known to be careless, and believed to be honest, the manager besides had a regard for him, and little was said, although something was no doubt thought, until the fortnight was finally at an end, and the time had come for John to reappear. Then, indeed, the affair began to look black, and when inquiries were made, and the penniless clerk was found to have amassed thousands of dollars, and kept them secretly in a rival establishment, the stoutest of his friends abandoned him, the books were overhauled for traces of ancient and artful fraud, and though none were found, there still prevailed the general impression of loss. The telegraph was set in motion, and the correspondent of the bank in Edinburgh, for which place it was understood that John had armed himself with extensive credits, was warned to communicate with the police. Now this correspondent was a friend of Mr. Nicholson's, he was well acquainted with the tale of John's calamitous disappearance from Edinburgh, and putting one thing with another, hasted with the first word of this scandal, not to the police, but to his friend. The old gentleman had long regarded his son as one dead, John's place had been taken, the memory of his faults had already fallen to be one of those old aches, which awaken again indeed upon occasion, but which we can always vanquish by an effort of the will, and to have the long lost resuscitated in a fresh disgrace was doubly bitter. "McEwen," said the old man, "this must be hushed up, if possible. If I give you a cheque for this sum, about which they are certain, could you take it on yourself to let the matter rest?"
"I will," said McEwen. "I will take the risk of it."
"You understand," resumed Mr. Nicholson, speaking precisely, but with ashen lips, "I do this for my family, not for that unhappy young man. If it should turn out that these suspicions are correct, and he has embezzled large sums, he must lie on his bed as he has made it." And then looking up at McEwen with a nod, and one of his strange smiles, "Goodbye," said he, and McEwen, perceiving the case to be too grave for consolation, took himself off, and blessed God on his way home that he was childless. Chapter 5 The Prodigal's Return. By a little afternoon on the eve of Christmas, John had left his portmanteau in the cloakroom, and stepped forth into Prince's Street with a wonderful expansion of the soul, such as men enjoy on the completion of long-nourished schemes. He was at home again, incognito and rich. Presently he could enter his father's house by means of the passkey, which he had piously preserved through all his wanderings. He would throw down the borrowed money, there would be a reconciliation, the details of which he frequently arranged, and he saw himself, during the next month, made welcome in many stately houses at many frigid dinner parties, taking his share in the conversation with the freedom of the man and the traveler, and laying down the law upon finance with the authority of the successful investor. But this program